I heard that you start the show by playing the flute live jazz flute, and then you always cut it out before you broadcast. Is that true?
How did you know?
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 20, part 1 of 2. Today, all my wildest dreams came true. Okay, only one, but a big one. I got to interview my design superhero, Jeffrey Zeldman. I knew quite a bit about Jeffrey just from the close to 2 decades of following his incredibly influential work, just as perhaps some of you have. But I got to dive deep with Jeffrey and hear a side of him and stories I don't think many of us knew about. I'm eternally grateful to Jeffrey for his time that he offered to me so generously, because this is the longest interview I've ever conducted. That's why I've chosen to break this special interview up into 2 parts. I'll stop talking now and let you jump right into part 1 of my unforgettable interview with web design icon Jeffrey Zeldman. Jeffrey Zeldman is the godfather of web design and unquestionably the greatest friend of the web. He's the guy behind his highly esteemed web design content initiatives such as A List Apart, An Event Apart, and A Book Apart. He's a prolific speaker and heavily influential blogger. He's the author of our industry staple, Designing for Web Standards. He's the host of one of my favorite design podcasts, The Big Web Show. He's also the founder of renowned web design studio, HappyCog. And back in the day, he played synth and Casio tone with the Insect Surfers, a DC post-punk techno surf band. Welcome, Jeffrey. I'm super excited to have you on User Defenders today.
Hey, you are way too kind. Hi, Jason.
All right. So as you know, every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments just to give us a look into your personal life.
I have a daughter. I'm a single dad, and I spend a lot of time with my kid. I like to read, but lately less and less. I've become more and more visual in the last few weeks. And I've been on Pinterest for hours at a time. Just discovering stuff. Like, did you know there's a street artist named Zhang Bao from China? I didn't before I started messing with Pinterest. It's just, you know how the web works. One link leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. And I start collecting things and I notice, the same illustrator credit on 2 of these things. I'm looking at pulp, right? Because I love pulp books, old pulp crime stories with lurid covers. And I start noticing that many of them were made by Robert McGinnis. And so now I know who that guy is. So I start looking up what else did he do and so on and so forth. So it's kind of like a college education, postgraduate education in pop culture, in graphic design, you know, just anything I'm interested in. I start looking up different uses of a typeface. It's pretty amazing. And I'm collecting everything.
That's awesome.
Before that, I was taking long walks through the streets of New York and photographing pretty much any building that caught my fancy. I studied photography for a little while in college, but back in the day when they were film cameras and you developed it by yourself, you know, by hand and all that stuff. And I actually knew how to use a light meter and all those things, which I don't remember now. But, and I do yoga. And three times a week, I work out with a trainer doing it's a combination of ballet bar, and it's almost like I'm blanking on the word. It's a wonderful exercise. Mostly women do it. New kind of Pilates. Kind of like Pilates without the equipment, because there's lots of stuff you can just do where your body provides the resistance. And, you do it and you train, but it doesn't really break down your – it's not as intense as the weight training I used to do. It's gentler, because I find as I get older, I need to – I want to stay fit, but I don't want to – I mean, I messed up my knee doing stuff like blind Bosu squats. with a trainer in the past, where you stand on a BOSU ball. You know what that is?
I have no idea what that is.
So it's like a half ball. Like imagine if somebody could take a soccer ball, make it puffier, cut off 2/3 of it, but leave this 1/3, and it would still stay puffy and filled with air somehow magically. And then you have to stand on that. And then while you're standing on it, you're doing squats. But you're doing squats while holding Russian kettlebells, right? Which are these weights, these free weights that you hold. And while you're doing that, you're blindfolded. So that's what I was doing. And, you know, at the time I thought, this is amazing. I'm an athlete. I can do anything. And then, you know, I messed up my knee. So now I can't run. So it's like, I'm going gentler now.
There's so much more to you than we even know, than we even understand.
Well, I have to, you know, there's a lot of things people do to unwind from the pressures of work and the creative work and stuff. And a lot of those things are not healthy. And I've done some of those things in the past, but I'm trying to just find healthy ways to detox from my own stress. Mm.
Yeah, and I love the photos. I watch the photos you post, and I love what you capture. And there's some great inspiration out there in New York City. I know it. So I love what you do there.
And web design and architecture similar in a lot of ways, right?
Hmm. Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's like grids and patterns, and you know, there has to be an overall structure, but there's also the detail. Right. And there's repetition and variation. There's, you know, all the, you know, design is design. And then we make things that people use, and architects make things that people use. Right. It's not, a building is not a sculpture. People don't just come and look at it and admire it and walk away. They live in it and they move stuff around. And then after a while, they'll knock down an inner wall because it doesn't meet their needs. And that's what happens to the sites that we design and the applications that we design. You know, we try to figure out all the good use cases and everything else, but eventually a business need changes or users start doing something like hashtags, and all of a sudden you have to change, you know, so the architecture has to change. This website has to change with or without your participation.
Yeah, the 13th floor.
Do you have the 13th floor in Denver?
No, I don't think so.
We have it in a few buildings in New York, and it's always interesting when you do get one. Of course, every building that's 13 stories tall or higher has a 13th floor, but they all pretend they don't.
Yeah, bad luck, right?
And I just find that so strange.
Well, Jeffrey, tell us your origin story. What inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field?
Well, it's funny. It's not something I was seeking. There wasn't really much of such a thing as web design. By the way, do you still say web design? And you're a web designer. You say you're a user defender. But if someone asks on an airplane, what's your job title? What do you say?
You know, and that's a wonderful question. I actually will say UX now, because that's sort of the buzzword, right, of our industry. But I wish I could say I was just a web designer. I hate saying just for anything because that's what started it all for me, was web design and following your work especially.
When you say UX to somebody sitting next to you on a plane, do they have a better sense of what that is?
Nobody has any idea what that means. Okay. I have to give the elementary school definition. I was watching your video.
Pitch.
Yeah, it's like design stuff for the web. I design mobile and web experiences. And even that confuses people.
And isn't it funny that we have to say mobile and web? Like,
right, like it's two separate things.
Right, yeah. But you do. I say all these things that I don't believe. It's sad. It's like, you know.
It is.
We're so passionate about these little differences, but then we blur them over ourselves when talking to, you know, the public.
I agree.
So you asked a question, and I started. I failed at a lot of stuff first, right? Mm. So I drew all the time as a kid, and I made up comics, and I really wanted to be an artist. And I really wanted to be a musician. I used to sneak out of school with my brother, who's a drummer. He's a great musician still. And we would, I remember my parents would be at work, and my dad had two tape decks, and we would set them next to each other to try to do multi-track recording, right? And it was crazy. Like, we'd play the loud electronic instruments first, right? Like, he'd play the drums and I'd play the organ. I'm sorry, no, we'd play the quiet instruments first. I'd play the guitar, he'd play the harmonica. And then he'd try to drum to the first tape deck. And I'd try to play keyboards to the first tape deck. We really didn't know what we were doing, but I really wanted to be a musician. I didn't want to, there was a bunch, I wanted to, I loved film. There was all these creative things I wanted to do. So my dad used to say, you can't be a dilettante, you have to pick something. But I never really could, which it turns out is great for the web. It turns out that if you're kind of good at design and kind of good at writing and kind of, if you're kind of good at a lot of things, then you can be, and you're passionate about all of them.
Yeah.
You can actually be very, very good at this profession.
Amen.
But at the time, you had to sort of, you know, so I was a journalist for a while, and I ended up writing for the Washington Post, and then they fired me one day. I never knew why. And when I was writing for them, they were paying me 30, I was freelancing as a stringer, they called it, and I was getting $35 per article, which isn't much. And although I don't think that situation has improved for journalists. I was a musician, like you said, with the Insect. The Insect Surfers were the most popular group I played with, so that gives you some idea.
Awesome.
I did a bunch of stuff. I was a security guard. I did a bunch of stuff, and I never really... I wrote 3 novels in very early 20s. They were terrible. but, you know, if you don't watch TV, you're young and you don't watch TV, and, you know, we didn't have iPads, right? So yeah. I would do a lot of creative stuff. I was always working on something. And I sent cartoons in to The New Yorker, and they sent them back. Like, and notice, I didn't, like, try to find a local publication where the level of experience and talent that I had might actually be appreciated and I could grow. I just started at the top like an idiot. But anyway.
No, that's awesome. That's awesome.
I ended up in advertising because that was a place before the internet where... If you were kind of good at writing and kind of good at design and kind of good at a bunch of stuff and creative and smart and frustrated, you could make a living there. So I started in D.C., where I was living at the time, and moved to New York with a girlfriend. And then we broke up because, you know, we moved together. And I was in advertising in New York, and it was very, very competitive. I sometimes worked at really, really good agencies where I couldn't make a living and I was the worst person there. And I sometimes worked at bad agencies where I was paid very well and I was like one of the best people there. But good work wasn't ever being bought. You know, they wanted like Red Lobster for the seafood lover in you and stuff like that. And I didn't know how to find a place where... They were looking for great work, and they would pay a salary. I couldn't find that. Those places do exist, but they didn't for me. And I had gone to a place called Gray Entertainment. You know, there's a big agency called Gray. They once did a rebranding exercise in the 90s, and it consisted of they paid $3 million to this branding agency. And the branding agency took their, I think their logo was like the word gray in Helvetica, in the color gray. And the branding agency changed it to orange. Which, I mean, if you think about it, that's absolutely brilliant. But it's also, they spent, you know, $3 million on it or so. I was told. But they had an entertainment offshoot. They had an agency that specialized in entertainment. So yeah. I was leaving a place that was very creative, DeVito Verdi, but I wasn't really making a living there. And I was looking to make, you know, I was growing up and I needed to make a living. And so I'd gone to Gray Entertainment with the fallacious hope that a place that had artists as clients would want really creative advertising. The thing I told myself was, well, if I can do a good ad for, like, dishwashing liquid, then imagine if, you know, if the client is I don't know, the Beatles, right? How much better? So, and that actually wasn't true. They were some of the least creative clients in the world because basically if you have two actors in a story by Stephen King, you want to show the actors, and then you want to say Stephen King, and then you're pretty much done. You don't want to, right? They were doing a remake of The Shining. And, like, why would you do that?
Why remake it?
It was like,
good
yeah,
luck.
Because Kubrick's a hack, and, you know,
right.
the cast, you know, Jack Nicholson, Scatman, Crothers, you know, they could what's your name, Olive Oil?
Written by M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, it was like they couldn't top it, but they thought they could. So, and we were trying to sell them ads like, you know, Red Rum and stuff, and they didn't want that. They wanted a picture of the actors they were using and Stephen King's name real big. So that was kind of frustrating. And, I could have, by now, I think I would be a raging alcoholic working on catalog copy for, like, I don't know, Boots or something. But one day, one of our entertainment clients was Warner Brothers, and the vice president of marketing was a guy. Oh my gosh, I just blanked on my friend Don Buckley. Sorry.
Okay.
That was scary. Don Buckley, because this guy changed my life. Don Buckley said, this is 1995, and he said, there's this new thing, the web. We think it's going to be pretty big, and we think it would be great to make a web, what's called a website. For our upcoming Batman movie, right?
Yeah.
And he said to the agency, do you guys know how to make websites? And the president of the agency, Len Foggy, lied and said, yes, of course. And Len came back and said, hey, to me and two other guys he thought might, do you know how to make websites? And we lied and said, oh, sure.
Good
and
answer.
When I first saw the web, I mean, the Netscape 1.1 had just come out.
Oh, Lord.
It was very primitive.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my first thought was, man, AOL's going to kill this. There's no way this web thing is going to catch on. Look how ugly it is. But my partners were Alec Pollock and Steve McCarron, and we didn't know all the things that you couldn't do.
Mm.
We were very ignorant, and so we made a great website because we did all these design things that you shouldn't have been able to do. And we just sort of forced the web to do them. And, you know, keep in mind, there was one browser. So we made stuff to work for that browser, like you'd make stuff that would work in any other piece of software. Mm. Right, like we looked at it like a CD-ROM, I guess, if you remember those.
Oh, yeah, Shockwave.
Yeah, well, it was way before Shockwave, obviously. Yeah. So it was HTML. But Netscape had just invented a technique where you could tile a background image over and over again to make a full screen background. And then you could put a different background on top. So we made all these houses, these buildings that looked like different parts of Gotham City. And we had a front page animation, a loading screen, basically, in 1995. All the things that I would later hate and swear never to do again, we did on our first site. And we used, there was a guy named Doug Rice from an agency called Interactive 8, and where the 8 was a number. He wrote a Perl script that swapped images as soon as they loaded, and the effect was this sort of crude stutter start animation. And then Steve McCarron took the Bat logo and shrank it by 20% and 20% and 20%, and then reversed the series of images so it looked like the thing was coming toward you. It looked like the bat was coming toward you. And, you know, and once that had finished the sequence, we used HTTP refresh to take you to our core page. So we did all these things. Yeah, we did all these things that were amazing.
And that's so out of the box, especially then, at that time.
Yeah. And it's like the direct manipulation of the material was really impressive to me because I was in advertising, and in advertising, you needed money to get anything done. You needed client approval to get anything done. If you were just going to add like a wipe on a commercial, you'd have to go into a special effects house, right? Nobody was doing this on their own Mac, right? You'd go into a special effects house and they would, you know, charge $1,000 an hour to like make a traveling mat. So anything that you conceived and you kind of didn't know, like when you set type, you didn't know if it sucked until it came back from the typesetter, Right. And, but then here, all of a sudden on the web, you had this control. Admittedly, there were a lot of constraints. There was a lot you couldn't do, but that's probably what made it feasible. Like if the web of today had existed then, I doubt I would have jumped in with both. Yeah. It would have been too scary. But
same here.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to talk about that.
But, yeah. Well, I love that. I mean, I appreciate you diving into that. And I want to get nostalgic here briefly, just sort of piggybacking off of what you said about, I love what you said. You said, we didn't know all the things you couldn't do then. And I feel like I'm kind of coming to a place where I get so nostalgic. I've just turned 40 recently, and I remember the early days of the web. Well, thank you, I guess.
No, it's great. It's great. 40's good.
Thank you. Yeah, and I remember how simple things were, and I remember just how uncharted everything was, and there's just this part of me that wants that back, but then there's the other part of me that goes, well, we can do so much more now with all the advancements we have. So I'm so torn in the middle of these things, but I feel like maybe there's a balance. Maybe there's hope that there can be a balance where we can become like kids again, where we don't know the boundaries, we don't really care about the judgment yet, and we just are free to create and serve people and create things that change lives, and we don't get so caught up in the minutiae of the complexity and the things that I think make a lot of people quit now, nowadays.
Are a lot of people quitting? I get the feeling too.
I don't know. I don't have data on that, but if they're not quitting, they're throwing their hands up in the air.
I'm hearing a lot of that, yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what I'm reading about. And that's one of the reasons I started the show, Jeffrey, was to try to help people, help be sort of a light tower, a way to sort of help guide and commensurate, too, as designers of all the challenges that are before us now with everything.
So the user you want to defend is us, in a way.
Yeah. Interesting. Yes.
Right. I mean, that's always true. I mean, have compassion. It's like having empathy for your client as the first user you're going to have empathy for, right?
Interesting. I never thought about it that way.
If you don't have empathy for the client, it almost doesn't matter that you have this great empathy for the end user, because you're never going to get to act on it.
That's true. Let's continue going deeper, my friend. This is awesome.
Okay.
This episode is brought to you in part by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Whether you started as a digital company or not, we're all digital now, and that's been a tough transition for many organizations. Universal Mind helps mid to enterprise-sized companies find and deliver something valuable through design thinking workshops, UX design and development consulting, and believes in supporting user defenders to help train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. Who has been the biggest superhero in your work and why?
Wow, that's really hard. There are so many people that I've worked with who've done amazing things. Like there was someone, I don't want to single people out because it's almost like... there's so many people that I'm not going to be able to mention just by virtue of we only have an hour and there are more questions to ask. But
yes, there's a lot more.
But for instance, there was someone, Erin Kassane is someone who I really admire. She was the editor of A List Apart for a long time, and she really professionalized it. At the time, there were originally, I was doing everything on List Apart, and then, like, Nick Fink was doing production, and there were some other people helping, for sure. There were different studios that helped, like, make, for a while, we had message boards and stuff. But Erin Kassane was somebody, she was very young, and she wrote to me and said, I really like your magazine, and there's an error on such and such article. I'm not trying to be rude, but there's a grammatical error. And I said, oh, thank you very much. And then she wrote and said, oh, I hope I'm not becoming a pest, but there's an error on this article as well. And I said, do you want to be my proofreader? I can't pay you. And she said, yes. And
bless her.
She was proofreader for maybe a month. And I said, you're not a proofreader. You're an editor. And then a little while after that, I said, you're an editor. I mean, you should be editing this whole magazine. And she started the... I think from the very beginning, it was professional in the sense that the content I was putting out there, I was passionate about it. It was really important to do things the right way, to try to figure out what could we be doing to, this sounds all phony, but like to change lives and, you know, and really make something great.
Yeah.
But I didn't have, and I can write and I can edit kind of, but to have a real editor and to have her eventually bring it. And then we've had just one great editor after another since then. But I think she started that. So she's a hero to me.
Mm.
Linda Wyman is who just sold Lynda.com.
Oh, yeah.
Huge hero to me. She had a book out when I started called Designing Web Graphics. I don't know how she did that. In 1995, she already had a book out. And she then did like Designing Web Graphics 2 and all this stuff. And it was really, talk about like playful, experimental, fun. She was a fun writer and she seemed to be, just seemed to know things. I don't know how.
Yeah.
And there was a guy, David Siegel.
Oh, yeah.
He'd written Designing with Web Standard. Oh, no, I wrote that.
No, that's you.
Jeez. Oh, I feel ridiculous. He wrote...
Creating killer websites.
Creating killer. He wrote another book too, and they were both really
Secrets of Successful Websites.
Yes,
I know because he was one of the guys too where I read his books and I was like, I got to do this. This is what I'm going to do for a living.
Yep. He made layouts using tables.
Yes.
And and knowing what we know now, of course, you know, that doesn't sound good, but it was brilliant.
Absolutely.
And he wasn't the only person experimenting with how to make layouts, but he was one of the first, and he sort of systematized it, and he was one of the first who brought real aesthetics to it. He said, like, you know, you can turn on borders. Don't. Mm-hmm. Like, right? There was all these things you could do that would hack it up and make it terrible. All the stuff, you know, and later after he left, you know, people started reintroducing curling pages and drop shadows and all that. But he was really against that. He really had, it was a print aesthetic, but it was a pretty good aesthetic for the early web. I think it leapfrogged us 5 years ahead of where we would have been.
Absolutely.
I read his book, his website, WebWonk, which he wrote before he wrote Creating Killer Websites. That was 1996. 1995, he wrote WebWonk.
Uh-huh.
I read that like three times. And then I went back to the Warner Brothers site that we'd just finished and delivered and sold. And nobody was, and I said, I was friends with the producer from Warner Brothers. And I said, I asked her if she would give me the fetch the URL and password, login and password and fetch, so I could go back and put margins in, because now that I'd read David Siegel, I knew how to put margins in, because text was wall to wall up until that point. And this was like 2 weeks after delivering the thing. There's so many people that I've worked with who are great, and I'm still working with who are great, and I look up to them, and I feel bad just singling out these two people, these three people. But, there's a lot of remarkable people in our field, I think.
No, totally. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And I know it's hard for you to pick just one, and certainly it doesn't do any less justice to all the great people you've worked with and the great people you've discovered, Jeffrey, because I've come to the conclusion that you are the A&R rep of the web. And the great leaders are you always have a way of just finding these people and giving them a platform. And I saw that moving South by Southwest Interactive Hall of Fame tribute video with just as a testament of what I just shared there. So I just really admire you and appreciate all you do. You great leaders propel their people above themselves, and you are that. So I just want to tell you that.
I don't really feel like a leader, but thank you. But I do think I recognize other people's talent, and sometimes when others don't. most frustrating things for me when I was in advertising is when I had a really good partner or was working alongside another really good team, and I would see them not being respected and not knowing how to get respected, not knowing how to sell their ideas. It was very frustrating to watch. And I think, you know, as designers, we have an obligation to sell our ideas. And, you know, but also I think, I don't know, there's just a certain respect for people that that's in our profession that I like. And to me, one of the thrills of doing this stuff is finding new people who are really good at something and just letting them do that.
Absolutely. This episode is sponsored in part by User Testing, the fastest and most advanced user experience research platform on the market. There's nothing like watching and hearing from people using your product, and that's exactly the insight User Testing gives you. You get valuable feedback on websites, mobile apps, and prototypes from real people in your target audience. Set up your study in minutes and get video, written, and audio feedback in an hour. You can try user testing for yourself for free by visiting peak.usertesting.com. Peak gives you a free 5-minute test on any website or app.
Jeffrey, let's talk about life-altering experience and get into your transformation. Now, every superhero goes through some sort of life-altering experience that helps guide them and helps them harness the powers they have for the greater good. Certainly significant among those is failure. Now, failure is not something we like to talk about or put on our LinkedIn page, but it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Now, you mentioned before when we were talking about your origin story and how you've had a lot of failures that have sort of led to your successes. I'd just like to ask you, can you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Well, the biggest thing in my life probably was I'm an alcoholic, and I did probably 13 years of uncontrolled drinking. Right? I didn't end up in a gutter yet. Right? I mean, that's out there. That option is out there should I choose to drink again. But,
Sure.
And I didn't kill anybody while I was out there. Like, you know, a lot of nice people come out of a blackout in jail and find out that they ran someone over. And, you know, the thing about voluntarily giving away control of your mind and of your ability to perceive accurately what's happening around you is that you can make... You can do really terrible things that you would never do in your right mind. And I don't know, I mean, it's complex why some people become alcoholics and others don't. I think something like 1 out of 7 people who drinks will become alcoholic or will drink alcoholically. And yet nothing like that. Most of them do not become sober, right? So most of them... you know, the so-called lucky ones go on benders and then they recover and maybe their spouse is angry at them and, you know, their kids grow up scarred. But they think they're lucky because they can still, you know, get a buzz on every once in a while. I felt physically ill unless I was drinking. I would drink in the morning. Like brushing my teeth, like crazy.
Crazy.
So, and I still remember what that was like. And I saw a guy the other day. I was walking home with my daughter, walking home from school. Walking her home from school or from somewhere. It was over the weekend, so it wasn't school. We were walking from somewhere, I guess the gym. And there was a guy standing outside the liquor store, and he wasn't homeless. He hadn't hit bottom. But I could tell, I looked at him, and I could tell he was struggling with himself whether to go in or not. And it broke my heart, and I couldn't, like, walk up to him and say something. But I just felt immense gratitude that I wasn't there. Yeah. And I think, in a strange way, it really helped me, because what I had to go through, you know, and the destruction it wrought, you know... In my love life and professionally. I mean, I can remember being fired and being told, it's not about your problems. And me going, what problems? And then just like shutting up because I didn't really want to hear. But what I did to get sober, right, I went to the 12-step program, right, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did everything they said.
Yeah.
And I made coffee, and I swept the floor, and, you know, and I would get there early and leave late and do everything. And it gave me this sort of volunteer mindset, this, like, don't focus on yourself because that's how you got into trouble, right? Why doesn't so-and-so love me anymore? Why didn't they promote me? All the resentments that people love, you know, everyone has resentments, but alcoholics really cherish them because it lets us keep drinking,
sure,
right? Mm-hmm. I should be the creative director by now, right? Why aren't I the creative director? Glug, glug, glug. In order to not do that, I had to really, like, not be about myself. And 2 years into that process, 2 years into my recovery, the web came along. So in the same way that I was sponsoring other alcoholics and going to meetings all the time, I just started not evangelizing. Well, I guess evangelizing the web to some extent, but I just started, you know, in AA, you get to keep your sobriety by giving it away, by helping another alcoholic. And I did the same thing with the web. It was like, this is so cool. Anybody can make this stuff. Anybody can learn to do this. And I was like, well, okay, so you're not a designer. Well, how can you make something that doesn't look terrible? Like, well, what are some of the mistakes non-designers make? Well, they use every font and every color. So don't do that. You can, you know, even if you're not a designer, you can learn to restrict your color palette and restrict your font choices and start making something that looks better. So, like, in every way that I could, and I didn't, mentor isn't really the right word, but I just really wanted to, and I was inspired by Linda Wyman and David Siegel, too. Like, they just gave it away. So I thought I should do that, too. And I think that is responsible for my career because... you know, and I wasn't planning. I wasn't doing it for that reason. But I would end up later, you know, people would come to our studio who had heard about, who'd read an article I'd written or read my book or something. This still happens, right?
Yeah.
So it's like you pay it. Is that paying it forward? Is that, I don't know what that, and you know what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Giving back.
You're doing it, and... I don't know if it's bringing you more clients now, and I don't think that's why you did it, but I think that it will bring you interesting work because, I mean, that's the nature of this.
Yeah. Well, Jeffrey, I want to first of all, I want to congratulate you on your sobriety.
That's,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, huge victory.
Luck and blessed and all that.
Absolutely. And I thank you for your vulnerability and sharing that with our defenders and with myself. So thank you so much. I identify with you. I also had a really big alcohol problem, and that led into many other things, too, where alcohol wasn't enough for me to where I was waiting at the liquor store at 6 in the morning because I hadn't slept. I was waiting for the liquor store to open. I needed something to help with the come down. It was bad,
man. I did that, too. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. It becomes the new normal, and it's a really unhealthy way because you feel like you have to even be normal and to be able to even talk to people, you have to be completely slogged up and completely out of your mind. And
I remember having some guy I'd known in college who became a cocaine dealer, and I remember briefly because early in advertising I was exposed to it, and I remember, like, going through hundreds of dollars, which was all I had in, like, a few days, and suddenly realizing I didn't have any more money. And instead of having, like, moment of clarity there, I just thought, what am I going to do? How am I going to be able to listen to music? Mm-hmm. How am I going to be able to, like, have breakfast? Like, I can't, you know. It's so amazing. Now I don't even, of course I have coffee in the morning, but I can even get up and function without it.
Mm.
Like, to just be able to get up and drink water and function is amazing.
That's a superhero talent right there. Because I cannot function without coffee.
Well, initially. Yeah. If you go too long without it, it's going to hurt. But
Well, that's awesome.
Thank you for sharing that. I did not know that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a lot of it's... embracing who you are. I mean, we're all created so unique, and there's nobody like us. And I think that a lot of times we just, because of maybe schoolyard bullies or putting our work out there or just not believing in ourselves enough, we start to believe the lies, and we don't embrace. We feel like we have to be somebody else to be great. Or one of my messages.
You just nailed it. Thank you.
One of my messages with this is be more of who you are. Because there's no one else like you. And yes, we can all talk about the same things, but nobody can talk about it like you can and with your unique experiences.
It's the same reason a lot of times people say, I can't blog, I can't write, because all these people have already talked about it. And just like you said, they have, you haven't.
Exactly. There you go. Bam. Okay, this is a good stopping point for part one. Did you enjoy that first half? I know I did. The second half dives even deeper. Be sure to subscribe at userdefenders.com/subscribe so you don't miss it. Defenders, I have put together a survey. It's a really quick survey. It'll probably only take about maybe 3 to 5 minutes to complete. It's over at userdefenders.com/survey, and it's really an opportunity to hear from you directly about what I'm doing well, what maybe I could be doing better. There's a lot of different things that I ask about, and it's really to get to know you more and to serve you better. So please take a minute if you have it. 3 to 5 minutes, I think, is all it should take. It's at userdefenders.com/survey, and I want to thank you in advance for taking the time to do that. I want to thank Cesar Limas for the astonishing superhero artwork, Chris Combs for the superhuman editing, and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.